On this edition of the Taking a Walk podcast, I'm here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to meet up with one of the greatest keyboard players of our generation. Billy Payne is a founding member of the amazing band Little Feat. Simply put, they changed my life when I saw them many years ago at the University of Cincinnati Fieldhouse. Boz Scaggs was on the bill, but the deal was Little Feat at that show, and it was possibly the greatest performance that I ever saw. Let's go take a walk with Billy Payne.
Taking a walk with Buzz Knight.
Well, Billy Payne, it is so great to be with you taking a walk. How are you, my friend?
You know, I feel good. It's been an intense month or so. Last night we played, which you were there at the Beacon Theater in New York, and the audience, not only there, but every place we've played has just been, they've been ecstatic. I think they come in with this expectation that we'll be good, but they don't know. Although the word is out now that the drum beat is that we're doing okay. But in the beginning, we'd hit the stage and I'd be looking at people and they're like, please make this work. When they hear it from the opening salvos of the concert, they're like, they kind of relax, and then it's just pure joy, and I feel so proud to be a part of that.
It is pure joy. The audience loves it. It's the anniversary Waiting for Columbus tour, kind of, sort of, right?
I mean, yeah, it's 45 years, which is, an interesting, usually you'll wait till 50 years, but I think choosing 45 years is a good thing. I just turned 73 in March. I play like I'm a 20-year-old, but facts are facts.
I love it. I love how you're playing. I love how the band is playing. So when did you first realize that you were hooked on being a musician?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I'll twist it just a little bit and say that I realized that I was a musician first when my woodshop teacher, Mr. O'Connell, said, I'll give you a passing grade, Bill, but stay away from the saws.
That stuck with you.
It was in seventh grade. I went, really? He knows that I play? Well, I've been playing for a while. I started playing piano when I was five, taking lessons from Ruth Newman in Ventura. But I think, so when I was 15 and started playing in a band, I think that kind of solidified the camaraderie of what it is to be in a band. And it's odd because there's so many things in life. You think, oh, I'm from the Groucho Marx school of thought, which is I would never accept an invitation to a club that would bring me in as a member. And yet, I gotta say that being a musician and being in a band is the ultimate club, other than maybe being a president or somebody like that. We Keith Richards, when I was in Amsterdam, 74, maybe 75, we were down the basement. The Stones had come en masse to hear Little Feat play. Jop Eden Hall, I think it was called. And I'm down there, I'm going, oh, Keith, oh my gosh. He grabbed me around the shoulder, pulled me in tight, and he says, oh, mate, we're all part of the same cloth. And it was like, welcome to the club, Bill, you know? And then when I was reading his biography, I can't remember the other fellow that wrote it with him, but he had a similar thing when he was in the dressing room with Muddy Waters and Little Richard, right? And he thought, well, if those are the cats, I must be one of the cats too. So that was what he was sharing with me. And I've done that since with a lot of musicians, because we are a part of something not super special, but it's nice to be in that crowd.
And the energy that comes from playing for an audience, right, is so special.
Yeah, especially now, Buzz. I mean, not that it wasn't before, but I think music has taken on a larger role. And for this reason, I'll tie it into Richard Goodwin's book, which I've just started. And that book, I'll say it again, is It's called Remembering America, A Voice from the 60s.
Fabulous book.
Yeah, this man wrote speeches for John Kennedy, for his brother Robert later, for Eugene McCarthy, and for Lyndon Johnson, I believe. And he looked at the 60s as a failure, which indeed it was in many respects. We find ourselves now, 2022, and when the pandemic hit in 2020, we're in that precipice again of what is America? Is it a failure? Are we? And the way I've sort of compartmentalized it is we are an aspirational country. Our ideals are aspirational. I wrote a song called When All Boats Rise. Somebody wrote back to me in that combative, well, I don't have a boat. I said, well, it's not about you having a boat, okay? I mean, it's aspirationally, we ought to all have boats that will rise together when the tidings are good and when the tides are in. But we don't have liberty and justice for all either, which is aspirational. So, so for me, what is happening is music is now binding people together. We don't, in that audience, nobody was discussing politics last night. They were digging, you know, Fat Man in the Bathtub. They're singing along with Willin. we can get a fight soon enough, but it's nice to have something where we can kind of relieve the pressure a little bit, and thus music is more important now than it's ever been.
Yeah, I got chills when you're talking about it, because really, I talk about this in the Taking a Walk podcast. You know, why is music so important? Why is it so special? Why does it do the things in such a wonderful way to us that it does? It touches us. It lifts us up. It brings us down in certain times.
Yes.
But it's such an amazing thing. So I'm so glad you touched on the emotion of it, and in a way the neuroscience of it too, right?
Yeah, I think that it is not a benign art. I mean, Hitler used it to great effect. Trump used it to great effect with however he put it together to stir people's souls in a certain way. So it is not benign, but ultimately it can be uplifting and again, bind us rather than pull us apart. We just need those areas where it's like when you get sick, your body's fighting something that it can't control, and what doctors try to provide, and oftentimes they can, but most stuff has got to come through your head, through your brain, and that part of it is allowing a pressure release so your body can begin to function again. If this doesn't do it, if things are tight and fighting against each other,
yep,
it never works. So there's that analogy too, and the religious component, which is crazy, which we don't have to get into, but I would just suggest it with Abraham Lincoln, who said, well, I don't remember the quote, but it's about which God is on our side. Is he on our side, or is he on the Confederacy? You know, we've always got that thing going on. So we pick and choose. It's like a Chinese menu with people on our values and beliefs and core systems that we operate from.
So on this day that we're taking a walk, coincidentally,
yep,
it also happens to be the birthday of Lowell George.
Oh,
which
yeah,
is pretty remarkable.
Yes.
So tell me what you remember about the first time you met Lowell George.
I was driving from Santa Barbara, actually Isla Vista, I think, was where I was sleeping in people's apartments. I was sleeping on the beach. I was scared to death of driving on the freeways in L.A., so I hugged the right-hand lane almost the entire way down.
By the way, I still am scared to death when I drive there.
I don't blame you. It's like Gene Hackman in The French Connection. You just have to put the gas on the pedal and hope nobody hits you.
Yeah, close your eyes.
Yeah, close your eyes and pretend it's a dream. Anyway, I drove on Lowell's house. He was near... it was on Rowena, near Silver Lake, but not, it was just west of Silver Lake, and I can't remember the name of the town. But it was a little rustic home just off the street. The door was open. I heard some Eric Satie floating out of the front door. I walked up. There was this beautiful blonde girl, short, pixie kind of cut, haircut, and cross-legged on the floor. She goes, "Oh, you must be Bill. Lowell's expecting you. He'll be back in 5 hours." I said, "Well, what does he do when he's not expecting you?" So I went in there.
5 hours, you said?
Yeah. What's he do when he's not expecting? So I get in there and I start, first thing I see other than her and listening to this beautiful music is on the back wall there was a samurai sword. To the right of that in the corner was a sitar. Adjacent to the sitar was a library that had books by Carl Sandburg, Allen Ginsberg, Howell, I think. Last Exit to Brooklyn, which is a brutal book. Don't look it up, everybody. Let's see. And then he had this record collection, which was John Coltrane, Ohm. He had a couple albums by Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, Chester Burnett. He also had this this record that had joined the band on it, and it was a Smithsonian recording of like chain gang music. Oh Lordy, join the band, big bull rat gonna join the band, which we opened up Waiting for Columbus with.
Yeah.
So all that stuff was there, and by the time he came in, there's this famous story of Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. For the first time they met, they talked about everything under the sun. And that's kind of the way Lowell and I hit it off. By the time he got there, I actually felt I kind of knew him, but I didn't know him. And so we just discussed everything. And it wasn't like I didn't join the band that evening. I'd come to Los Angeles ostensibly to meet Frank Zappa. Well, Frank's over in Europe. So the record company, after many, many calls, which I did with a phony credit card, much like Steve Jobs and his partners, everyone was using these cards to make calls. And I'm Bill Payne, and I play keyboards, I think, and that kind of thing. So I was nervous as hell. I didn't know how to start, and they finally hooked me up with Lowell. The guy was just such an engaging, warm human being. I just felt like, well, this is cool. He said, well, come back in a couple of weeks and let's try and write something. So I did, and I think we were writing all these crazy songs that we presented to Ahmet Erdogan. Dancing to Nubile Virgin Slaves was one of them. It was an instrumental. And I don't know what else we had, but Ahmet heard the stuff and he looks at us, he goes, "Boys, it's too diverse." And we went back to the drawing room. And I think we started writing Truck Stop Girl, Brides of Jesus, Captain Gunboat Willie, Strawberry Flats. I mean, all these, Hamburger Midnight. So all these songs that the titles alone suggested there's some real eclectic thought going on. And there was. So you can only imagine what we played for Ahmet to have him say it was too diverse.
Yeah.
And I think that's the essence of Little Feet, the essence of where Lowell and I saw the vision for this band, was its eclecticism. It was an open proposition. Do we need horns? Do we need another guitar player? Do we want somebody else to fill in on keyboards every now and then? What are we going to do? Let's leave it open. Let's bring what we need when we need it. And it kind of set the tone of where we are now, which is, how can we call this band Little Feet? We don't have Lowell, we don't have Richie Hayward, our drummer. We don't have Paul Barrere, who passed away in 2019. We do it because we have the music, the catalog, and we're still writing. I've written 20 songs with Robert Hunter. I've written 9 songs, I think, with Paul Muldoon, who just did the editing for Paul McCartney's book of lyrics. He wrote the foreword as well. So there's it kind of boils down to music. And for a guy that was brought up playing classical music, I think, well, all right, Beethoven's not around. We still play his music. One guy years ago, Buzz, was saying, not to me personally, but they talked to a friend of his. He goes, well, why is Bill playing New Orleans music? He's not from there. Well, my parents were married there, so that's okay. But I told the guy, I said, well, tell him I'm not from Vienna and I play Mozart. I'm not from Hamburg and I play Beethoven. Is that okay with him?
Love it. And I love how you brought it full circle to the present in terms of where Little Feet is today.
Yeah.
And where that foundation that you and Lowell sort of laid out really to this day is the backbone of what Feet is all about, right? And you've, stayed true to that. You know?
Yeah, I think very few bands have a North Star. Very few people do. I mean, it's not anything you contemplate. I mean, even when Lowell and I were sorting that out, I didn't project, 50 years in the future plus to say this is what I'd be doing. I mean, I knew I'd be playing music. I mean, the only gig I've ever had, legitimate gig I've ever had, was a paper boy. So I played music all my life. Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing to be able to converse with people in many different creative ways, whether it's through my photography, through my writing, through my music, through songwriting. So there's a lot of subsets to everything, right? And this to friends, to have this conversation with you, Buzz, these are the things you hope will happen in the beginning, that you'll be connected to inquisitive people. And the curse of the Chinese living interesting times, which we definitely do. But have people that you can lean on during those times that don't necessarily hold the same beliefs, but hold that deeper belief in that there's a path we have in front of us. There are divergent paths. How do we ultimately connect through all that? That to me is the thing that really works. So I'm not a purist. If I want to play some jazz and throw in some stuff, that's what we took the audience on last night. We were rock and roll with Oh Atlanta, with Fat Man in the Bathtub, with Paul's tune, Old Folks Boogie. And you pop into Day or Night, Mercenary Territory. And it just takes you to another world. And it's like, that's what that formative and transportation of music is the most fun. Not to play, and we're listening while we play, obviously, but I every now and then we'll look out at the audience and we're like, yeah, this is a time to sit down, let this music wash over me. Now we can get up and dance or whatever we want to do. And you can't make anybody do anything. There's not cue cards saying, get up and dance, everyone. They either do it or they don't. It's the old adage of the gig itself. I think it was Goldwyn who said, if they're not going to show up, you can't stop them.
When I first went to that show that I referenced at the University of Cincinnati Fieldhouse, the show that I believe sort of changed my life in terms of the magic of an amazing performance, I remember some of my buddies from the University of Dayton, where I went to school, saying, you got to check this band out. You've never heard anything like this band. And that's what we did then, right? We were guys who were starting out at the radio station back there, and we just shared experiences before there was, social networks and everything. And they said, you gotta listen to this band. There's nothing like you've ever heard before. You can't compare them to anybody, which is so true. And then they were like, you gotta go see this band. So, I'm so grateful for them turning me on to you guys, and I'll never forget it, really, So what led to the period with Lowell deciding he had had enough? I know he had put out the solo album and everything. I mean, there were differences, right?
Yeah, he and I were at loggerheads, and I'd actually quit the band. I said, I can't take this, man. We take two steps forward, three steps back, one step forward, etc. And I got to do something else. If you want to continue Little Feet, please do. What I would suggest you do, however, is you love producing albums. Produce a couple more records. Do your solo thing. You've been working on that for a long time. Get out there and play your music. And then test the waters and see what... You need to make yourself happy. That is not happening right now. And when you're unhappy, it's like, it just... I'm not easy to get along with sometimes. So we just kind of let it go. But it was under that guise that he went on that last tour, and I got the call that he'd passed away in Washington, D.C., following, by all accounts, a brilliant performance of his solo endeavors.
Yes.
And Fred Tackett was out on that tour. So...
And you had been doing so much, session work also, right? You had worked with so many people from, obviously, Jackson Browne to Bob Seger and Doobie Brothers. And so you had some side action going on always, right?
Always. Even when I was in Santa Maria, I was with a group called the Debonairs, but there was a group called the Chevrons. I'd sit in with them. I was always sitting with people because I had the acumen to play just about anything, not everything. So in Lowell Pass, I wound up playing with Linda Ronstadt, and then I played with James Taylor for about 6 years. He's obviously a wonderful artist to have connected with. Lowell was 34 years old, right? Mozart was 34. So another way to look at what we're doing now, which I point out to people, is look, if you want to put Lowell or Little Feet or whomever in this band into a worship area, that's cool. Do so. But keep in mind, what we're doing is keeping this music alive, and thus we're keeping his memory alive. And because whatever travails were going on with him, with a lot of people back then, he was a creative soul, a brilliant musician. I think his phrasing was impeccable, honestly, and both as a singer and as a player. And so the guys that are in the band now, Scott Sherrard, who was the musical director for Greg Allman, when I met him six, seven years ago, when I was playing with the Doobie Brothers, he'd been studying Little Feet since like 12 years old.
Wow.
Same thing with Tony Leone, who's on drums. And he'd been studying Richie Hayward. But he's studying other people. These are guys that come into this thing with a wide swath of music and influences, which is another area Lowell and I discussed a lot. What are the influences? So as I said at the outset of our conversation, when I went into his house, I wasn't doing it on purpose, but that is in effect what I was doing, was viewing what had influenced him. So if you got jazz, you got there's an album that Zappa put out of Lenny Bruce. So there's that aspect of it. Lowell and I love the Marx Brothers. I mentioned Groucho earlier. There's a song called Alone. I think it was Jack Jones and Kitty Carlisle, I believe.
Oh, wow.
And Jack Jones did Dixie Chicken on The Tonight Show when Johnny Carson was on board. It's like a Dickinson tale, honestly.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, there's a lot of stories around why Lowell left playing with Frank Zappa.
Okay.
What's the one that you believe is the reason why?
Well, Frank asked him to leave. He asked him to form his own band. He did so upon hearing a song called Willin, which had drug references. Weed, whites, and wine. And Frank was not into to the weed aspects of it. So, but he also knew Lowell had a this is an untapped resource. And he set him loose, and Frank was helpful. So was Herb Cohen, his manager. And that's the story I have. I'll only say that when we first went in to sign the record deal, I think Herbie was there, or close in the vicinity. When we went and signed the record deal for Let It Roll, gosh, 87, 88, somewhere in there. Herbie was the first guy walking out of the new Warner building. And I reminded him of that. So there was this kind of bookends going on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you guys, during that period, when I was at QFM 96 in Columbus, you and Paul and Richie came in to the studio and did a scaled down version of a few songs, which was pretty amazing, pretty special radio, really, for that time.
You know,
sounded so awesome.
Cool.
Lowell was somebody who had a lot of great lines, right? I mean, he was quick to throw out some funny stuff. Any in particular that come to mind that are Lowellisms on this day, on his birthday?
You know, well, happy birthday, Lowell. Well, hope you're hanging out with whomever you love up there and wherever you are. His soul is someplace, that's for sure. I don't remember so much witticisms from here. I remember a lot more from Richie Hayward, who was from Iowa. But Lowell, he had that sense of humor where we'd be sitting around a table at Richie's house, and this is in West L.A., just off of Sunset Boulevard, and right next to the Cock and Bull restaurant. There were Spanish apartments that were there. These apartments were filled with writers, drug dealers, musicians, etc. But Lowell, like, get up on the window and put his face there and scare the hell out of us. He was just one of those pranksters, man.
He liked having a good time.
He did. He really did. And I think that's the essence of when people are having fun, which we did during the making of Pieces Don't Fail Me Now. His daughter, Anara, was born. And that was a really, I think that was a great time in his life. And for us, as a result of it. In many ways, he was like Jerry Garcia. During the times that were not exemplary of fun and joy, he kind of disappeared for periods of time, as did Jerry. And or what I've read and heard, you go, well, oh, he'll be back, don't worry about him. that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Fred Tackett, who's been with us for, he's one of the first people I met in L.A. Fred told me, remember when he was running for office for the Musicians Union? I go, no. Really? I go, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, rings a vague bell. Well, Fred got us our first gig with Jimmy Webb. At a paying gig, I should say, for Little Feet, at a Jimmy's birthday party in Encino, California. So Fred came from that world of, and he knew Lowell, a few years before I met him. He was playing with Sonny and Cher, Jimmy Webb. When you look at Fred's discography, it's about like mine. It's sort of like, well, when did you guys have time to go to the bathroom? You know, that kind of
stuff.
So it was nuts.
I love it. So there's a documentary in the works?
There is. Jesse Lauder is a director. There is a documentary he just has out now with Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks and Joe Cocker, Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Wow.
And so the survivors of that confluence all got together later, and they're reminiscing about Joe, and they had some great footage of Cocker when he was around and what that tour was about. So he knows how to tell a story, and ultimately, that's what I who I wanted was somebody that not only could tell a story, but listen to the story and that's there. We don't need to promulgate the bridge like a Monty Python skit. The bridge, the castle was built, it sunk into the swamp. The bridge was built, it was blown up by the, you know. That happens to everybody. You can always allude to something without being hammering it into the ground, I guess.
Sure.
And I think the better story is the creative aspect of what we were doing and how it ties into what we're doing now, all these years later. That's what Little Feet is. It's bigger than any of us, and I figured that out quite a few years ago.
Yeah, it's gone through so many generations, incarnations, you know, creative processes, and still cranking it out for sure. How do you use taking a walk yourself, probably, I'm assuming, out in Montana, to kind of, you know, help you creatively or inspire you? How were you able to do that in the wide expanse of Montana?
Well, I think anywhere. So much of what we do is compartmentalized, right? It's between the ears. But if you can find a place that it could, I mean, I found it just walking in New York City the other day. You're just looking, you're able to think, you can kind of settle down a little bit if you're not looking for buses that might hit you. It's just the reflective mode is really what you're involved in. And wherever you can find it, I mean, Duke Ellington used to get it to those reflective modes sitting in a cab, you know. Taking a shower, you go, oh my gosh, I got to retain this thoughts, or I can write it down when I get out of the shower, that kind of thing. The mind has a mind of its own.
And photography is relatively new for you?
Yeah, listen, like I said, I turned 73 in March. Same day as, James Taylor's a year older than me, but our birthdays are March 12th.
Happy.
Thanks. And I told James, you're like the canary in the coal mine. As long as you're doing good, I think I'll do good. But the photography, I began in my 50s. So I think, well, I don't know if Lowell said this, now that I think about it, but it is a truism that we talk ourselves out of far more things than we talk ourselves into. Oh, I can't do this because of that.
Yeah.
I play piano, but how many people in the world play piano? Shouldn't I be playing guitar? You know, that kind of thing. The inquisitiveness is what pulls us out of that, pulls us out of ourselves, which are either wildly ambitious or are completely in denial of what is in front of us. And it's an odd mixture, but the steps of jumping in that pool and taking the dive, before you take that dive, there's a lot that goes into your head. Temperature of the water, can I swim? How close is the side of the pool? Am I going to hit my head on the side of the pool? I mean, all those things that you just kind of build up and they stall the process. And what you want to do when you can as a creative person is to open that up to where the creativity will come out. In other words, stop editing yourself. Mm-hmm. So.
What beautiful advice for creative process.
Well, I'm just glad I've lived long enough to be able to articulate it. Because that was another thing. Remember the Tom Wolfe book, The Right Stuff? Those astronauts, and it wasn't manly, I guess, to question what they were doing. They just did it, right?
Right.
And we kind of adapted that attitude as well. In the 70s, of not looking or analyzing what we did. Why did we make that a 2-4 bar instead of a 4-4 bar? I just, well, I don't know, we just did it. And later I went, you know, I want to know why I'm doing this.
Right.
And the fear, I was talking to a guy, a driver in a car, taking me someplace. And he was a musician. And I said, do you ever like play scales or any of that stuff? And says, no, no. I said, is that because, or study music, because you think it will take away from your creativity? He said, yeah. I said, okay, I'm going to share something with you. When you add learning about a subject, in this case music, and the notion of playing scales, which John Coltrane did ad nauseum, they add to your vocabulary. They don't take anything away. He went, I never thought of it like that.
Wow.
I said, no, I didn't either. That's why I'm sharing it with you. You want to broaden your vocabulary, not restrict it.
Wow. Have you seen Chasing Train, the documentary on Hulu?
I did. We were talking about this last night. Also, the documentary on Bill Evans on Blue Note Records. And
I haven't seen those.
And lastly, Birth of the Cool on Miles Davis. And that was the one documentary I forgot. It was a John Coltrane documentary.
Lovely documentary.
You know, I'd see those.
Photography. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Going back to photography, you know Henry Diltz?
Yes.
Henry Diltz and I took a walk a couple weeks back in L.A.
Oh, cool.
And there was a beautiful moment. We're walking, and it describes, you know, him really beautifully, where we're taking a walk, and he had to stop at a very moment and whip out his little portable, you know, camera, whatever
sure.
it was, because he saw something in the window that was an image
yes.
that just was made him curious. And I was like, wow, at 83 years old, this guy is still loving his view of the world that he can kind of capture, you know?
That's right. Well, you see things, you know, and Henry is a wonderful photographer. He's taken photos of everybody, including Little Feet. And but I never, you know, what he brings to it, and what any photographer brings to it, it's kind of like a musician. We go through the auditory sources, but so he's, I would bet that he watched a lot of films growing up. And what you're doing is you're educating your eye to the best cinematographers in the world. Other work for John Huston or David Lean, Kubrick, on up and down. And so when you see something, you have a chance to, A, talk yourself out of it because, well, everybody's done it before, or you figure out that what's unique about human beings is we all have that little bit in us that shares our view of what that is. Maybe Kubrick's view has got a, or David Lean's has got a bigger picture to it. I mean, I don't mean literally, but the, well, actually it is literal. We're, that expanse is in Lawrence of Arabia. But maybe you're just capturing one of the mounds or the flow of the sand. It's all there, you know. Where does your vision literally and figuratively take you? And when I figured that out with photography for myself, when I hit that shutter, it was like hitting middle C on a keyboard. As a child, I went, oh no, now I'm off and running. My wife, Polly's a wonderful photographer too. There's an image of Richie Hayward that we showed last night in Time Loves a Hero. And it looks like the photo like this, it's raked up and he's like got this beatific smile on his face. He's playing the drums, it's in a sepia tone. She took that photo and he died 2 weeks later. And I told her, I said, what that photo exemplifies is this is where Richie lived, literally. He had so much fun. When he got off stage, he was shaking. We threw towels on him. So he only played two or three songs that night. It was up in Vancouver Island, I think. So, you know, Paul went to Japan a few weeks before he passed. And I know Coltrane, one of the last things he did was he went to Japan.
Yep.
And Paul was versed in that stuff. I got him a Charles Mingus book 1 year for his birthday. But that's where we gain inspiration from others. That's where the connectiveness of things. It doesn't always have to be music. It can be food. It can be politics. It can be obviously relationships, which are the most important. But they all inform everything else of who we are as human beings. And I think that's the thing that's the most dramatically upsetting to me this day and age. And conversely, the most where I get the most excited about things are the fact that there's so many people that just they don't want to intellectualize anything. To intellectualize is like taboo, you know. They're shutting themselves off from the world. It's how people like Hitler, any kind of dictatorship, they want that father figure. They're like, yeah, he's a bastard, but he made the decision, not me. Well, hey, we need to make decisions too. John Lewis, God bless him, you know what I mean? I'm not a religious person, but I gotta say that man had some soul. And he might have been more of the godfather of soul than even James Brown, where it counts.
You got some soul, Billy.
Thanks.
And thanks for the joy that you bring me still to this day and to many fans over the years and to this day. And I'm so grateful that we were able to take a walk.
Me too. I enjoyed the walk very much, Buzz. Thank you.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.